And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. And our guest is Ben Long, who is a native of North Carolina, a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, known throughout North Carolina, throughout the country, throughout the world for his inspiring collection of fresco paintings. But he's in Chapel Hill back and forth these days, back in Chapel Hill, I guess is the way to put it, because of his latest – one of his latest assignments, which is to do the presidential portrait for retiring university president Erskine Bowles. And I pulled him away from the oil and the easel for just a minute to share with us some of his impressions of coming back to Chapel Hill of his project painting Erskine Bowles. And then if possible, I'd love to tell him – get us to tell us a little bit about the work of which he's the master of the frescoes. So Ben Long, welcome.
Well, thank you.
You're getting to know our president, Erskine Bowles. So we know we won't ask you to comment on his work as president, but how does he compare as a subject of an art of an artwork of a painting? How does he compare
well,
as a subject?
A good subject. He's just not a very good sitter.
What is he? What does that mean?
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I've known him since I went to school here, and we worked together in some clothing store and got to know each other pretty well. And
so, is it a problem if you're too familiar with the subject?
It almost is. It's not that
he doesn't treat you with the respect that that the same kind of respect.
No. He has respect. I don't think he's used to posing like that. I don't. I know he must be used to having photographs taken, but in my particular technique, we never use photographs. So only from life.
One of the standard practices now for portrait painting is that you send the artist, you meet the artist, and then you send them a bunch of pictures, and the artist is able to work from those pictures. Why can't you do that?
I can't do that.
I said, why? I know you can't do that. Why?
I don't believe in that sort of thing. I think it's, first of all, what makes a portrait interesting is it's done from life. You're watching the person as they think and as they talk and as they move, even moving is not – if you can just get them in place every now and then, it'd be good. But a really well-observed portrait picks up all sorts of subtleties of the person you're painting. You can obviously, if they get into a quiet moment, their mind is going someplace else. You can sometimes catch almost what they're thinking. I mean, it's you want to make the portrait as living as possible. And I think that you can only do that from painting from life.
Can you describe the technique or how it is that a perceived feeling of what the subject may be thinking or showing can be transferred to the canvas in a way that reflects that feeling?
Well, it almost serves – I mean, it can also work against you. I've seen if you get on some sort of subject matter that is troubling to the sitter, they're going to give you a different expression than what you probably started with, which might be a lot.
So you'd have a on different days they'd have different feelings, and it might be confusing to you.
And they might come in not feeling very well themselves, or having just had an unpleasant conversation with somebody else, or they come in very cheerful and rested and everything. That gives you another whole way of looking at them and studying them.
is the communication between you and the person who's sitting for you silent, or do you have a – are you – or like when I go to the barbershop, sometimes we don't say a word, and the barber, I guess, probably can do a better job because he can concentrate on his work. Sometimes get into all kinds of arguments. He seems to enjoy things, but I wonder if he's concentrating on his work. How does it work with an
– Well, I think it's probably pretty closely in tune with that way of thinking. I mean, it's the sitter has a lot on their mind. If he or she sits still because they're thinking about something, I mean, that's usually a time where I can profit by studying them quietly and getting as much information as possible. It is more difficult when they're lively and they're talking and they're moving and
And do you ever have to just say, "Now be quiet, let's be quiet"? How, or do you tell you shut up? Or what? How do you talk to your? How do you talk to you?
I don't really try to get them to, unless it's becoming really frustrating for me. Then I'll probably say, "Can you just hold this for a little bit? You know, can you look this direction?"
Ben Long is our guest, and he's here in Chapel Hill working on a painting of the presidential portrait of a retiring president of the university, Erskine Bowles. And you've said that you've known Erskine since you all were here in college. But in general, is it a part of your plan to study, to do research on your subject so that you know a little bit about that person's experience and maybe what other people perceive as his or her character? Or is it better if you just take them as they appear to you when they sit or stand in front of you?
Well, I've known Erskine a long time, so I'm happy to see him and nice to be able to do his portrait. It means I get more time with him than normally.
Well, the rest of us would be jealous about that, even if you're not talking, just to have the time with him.
So it's.
But I'm thinking about in just in general as a. You mentioned that you're able, as you insist on painting your subjects live, not from a photograph, and part of the reason is that by viewing them in life, you're able to feel things and then transfer them to the portrait that you wouldn't be able to do if you just had a two-dimensional portrait. I mean, a photograph of them. And so I'm wondering, are there other things that enter into your portrait in the way that if you know that somebody is a successful politician or in Erskine's case knows how to manage money, but taking other subjects, whether or not if it's a woman, whether or not she likes horses or she likes dancing or she likes church work or she's famous as a kind, loving mother or she's a little bit acerbic, you know, and that some of these traits that you hear about and learn about, do you like to know about that in advance or do you like to make your own judgment based on just what you see?
Well, if I don't know the people, I don't mind confronting them right away. With when we meet to sit.
How do you mean confronting them by talking?
Tell me about yourself. I try to keep it pretty relaxed because it's one, it's hard to sit still, and I know it is. And that's at the same time, I don't want a rigid looking picture either. I mean, I do encourage them to talk if they feel like it. And ask questions if they are curious, and it relaxes things to a point where the person can be seen rather than a posed photograph, for example.
I'm sure that if when I ask you the question about how long does it take, you're going to say it takes as long as it takes until I'm satisfied with the work, or at least I believe that would be the answer you'd give. But when you're planning a project and entering into an agreement, a commissioning agreement about what it might cost or how much time you'd budget for a substantial oil portrait of an important person, I mean, do you have to budget 2 or 3 months of time or a week's time or a couple of days? Or do you even think like that?
No, I don't think like that. I mean, in this situation, I knew right away that it was going to be a pretty difficult project to even schedule anything. So I have to wait for when it's possible for him to give me some time to come down off the mountain.
We're visiting with Ben Long, and we've been talking about his latest assignment in Chapel Hill to paint the portrait, the presidential portrait of Erskine Bowles. Ben Long, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Ben Long. Ben, I know you mostly as the famous man who does the frescoes all over the state. I mean, that's the way most people know you.
Well,
you're like Jesus. You said you have said it. You're not going to.
When I studied in Italy, the man I studied with was teaching. Actually, he wasn't teaching. He was doing frescoes, and I worked as his apprentice. And of course, eager to learn something about painting. That happened to be the subject matter, the technique that I was given when I was studying with him. And the difficulty was to come back to North Carolina and try to find someone who even knew what a fresco was. And for the first couple of years, I nearly gave up because it was just a difficult thing to try to get people to understand what you're talking about. Plus, when you describe the amount of mess it makes when you're doing it, they right away hold up from volunteering a wall for you.
It's hard to believe that there's this legend that goes around that when you first came back to Italy, you not only couldn't get anybody to pay you to do a fresco, but you couldn't give them away. Couldn't give one away.
Well, the first two up in the mountains, they were given away. So they.
But I mean, you had to search around to get somebody to take one. That's the legend. So
the thing is, in Blowing Rock, where I was living, and my family was living there, there was one summer sort of gathering, a cocktail party at a painter friend's named Philip Moose.
Oh, from Davidson.
Davidson. And he introduced me to this Episcopal priest who was the Episcopal priest up in the mountains in Ashe County and said that I'd been looking around for some time to find a place to do a fresco. And wouldn't he like to have a fresco in his church? And he was a very enthusiastic fellow, and he said, sure. I'd love one. And they said, what's a fresco?
He thought it was a fluff drink maybe or something.
But, I mean, since he said sure, I jumped on it. And said,
so that's the legend's pretty substantial. That's pretty true. You did it for free. Now, what happened after that?
The second church up in the mountains was a really one of those wonderful old mountain churches that you just don't want to see disappear. And I think it was needing some kind of attention. And the priest, whose name was Fulton Hodge, we got to talking about it, saying, well, what would it take? And I said, well, if you want a fresco in this one, you'll probably have to build a brick wall, like a.
It was a wooden church.
It was a wooden church, and then we could possibly do a large painting, like a Last Supper. And he said, "Well, But how much would that take? And I said, I don't know. It'd take at least $2,500 to build a wall like that. I don't know. And then this old couple right behind us was sort of overhearing our conversation. And they said, well, how much does it take to build a And then, of course, Fulton turned and I think gave him a slightly higher price. But the guy took out his checkbook and signed it right there.
To build a wall, and then you were trapped into doing the fresco.
And then it was another sealed deal. Yeah.
Was that one for free, too? Did you do that for free? What about the cost of the materials and things like that?
That's the one thing I did ask for him to try to get the people of the church and everyone else, they sort of, you know, if they happen to have some kind of sand quarry, they gave us sand. It was a very community.
It was a mountain kind of –
And they'd bring in the food. Yeah, they were great.
Well, it was like the old times, I guess. But, I mean, the result has been – this was 30 years ago, I guess, or thereabouts.
That was finished in 1980. And then nothing happened for almost 2 years.
Except that right now I know that tens of thousands of people every year go out of their way to get West Jefferson into this little chapel up further up in the further off the main highway just to view these frescoes. I mean, it's become a substantial tourist attraction, but also, it makes Ben Long, the guy who drew him there. In addition to the inspiration of the work. So that was a good investment of your time.
Well, I mean, I really wanted to do frescoes. I mean, so I loved doing them, and it was lucky at the time. And again, it wasn't like it started some.
It didn't lead It didn't lead immediately and automatically to more work. It's now come like rain, I guess. But how did it lead to more interest in frescoes and more interest in your doing this and to the time when you could ask for a fair return for doing it?
Well, I think what happened is that Charlotte, of course, after this point, I had done about 11 or 12 frescoes in Italy. And the one I've finished up to that point was that had a certain amount of recognition was the I did a chapel in the Basilica of the Abbey of Monte Cassino, the one that was destroyed.
Right. No. Keep talking about this.
And being an American, of course,
there's a double connective link there.
Because we were the ones who bombed it.
Right, right.
But in fact, when I met the abbot, that's the first thing he said. And he said, you're an American.
So you owe it to us.
And he says, oh, yeah, you bombed. I said, well, I'm here to see what we can put back.
Wow.
So it's and it was an interesting time. It was like
so this was after Ashe County or about the same
that
time?
That one was it was a little before the last one, Glendale Springs.
So in between the two. How many in Italy?
About 11.
And were these all of these with you being the lead, or were some as an apprentice to your teacher from whom you learned?
Well, the first two were kind of given to me by the teacher mm-hmm. who was working in this church that he was determined to cover all the walls, I think. And so he gave me a small wall.
Was everything in Italy based on religious themes?
Yes, all the ones that I worked in or with him particularly?
We've got this Ben Long fresco trail in North Carolina now where you can spend several days going from place to place to see yours. Is there a Ben Long Italian? Is there a Ben Long trail in Italy? Can we get that going?
No, I don't think so. I think,
but, I mean, really, it might be fun to go and see another day. We're going to take a break because I'm getting off on a diversion. And let me take a break and get back on track. We're visiting with Ben Long. Ben Long is here in Chapel Hill to paint the oil portrait of Erskine Bowles. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ben Long is my guest. You know Ben Long because of the Ben Long Fresco Trail up in the foothills and in the mountains of North Carolina. These wonderful themed frescoes. One of my favorites, Ben, is the little – it's not right – in the little chapel in Montreat. This is the Prodigal Son fresco. Probably not your most famous one, but, man, it's nice. And it's got all the themes of this story, which Jesus – it's a parable. It's probably something he made up, but it's real in the sense that it describes a lot of family situations, real ones. Maybe that's not the best one, but will you tell us about either that one or another one about how that developed and how the theme developed and how you transferred the theme and worked it into a finished work?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I mean, one that was it had all the kind of drama you could ask for a fresco. To see the right kind of – to make it a clear message as well. And I tend to use my friends and mainly people I know and students. The fellow who's the prodigal son is actually one of our student teachers at our school that we started up in Asheville. The Fine Arts League, and he's I don't know if it gives him – makes him uncomfortable to have to show people that he was the prodigal son or not, but
Well, I believe I'd rather be the prodigal son than the brother.
Well.
Well, I don't know. The brother is – anyway, tell –
But we had – it was an interesting project because they were – just building that chapel, so they built the wall according to what we needed. So we actually had a really first-class venue for a change.
Ideal for a fresco in the sense it was designed for you.
Built in and built into the church, and it was strong. And we... It was an enjoyable time to do. In those days, I was still living in Europe, and then, so I would take the drawings back and blow them up to the size that they're going to be on the wall because I had my studio there.
You had a sort of duplicate of the of what the
wow. You have to duplicate it. Yes, and we
to do. Bigger sketches or bigger preliminary drafting of what it's going to look like. Well, let me interrupt you. We'll come back to the story, but you're in Europe. You've made your sketches based on, as you often do, real people in the neighborhood, and then you take it back to Europe, and you got a life-size reproduction of the chapel at Montreat where you sketch it out on paper. And then, I mean, my question is, and then do you bring the paper back and put it up on the wall of the Montreat Chapel before you begin your work to sort of, I'm so smart. then what goes on next?
Well, what we do is we trace the large drawings, and then you punch holes in them along the lines of the tracing, and then you it's at that critical time that's before you put on the plaster which is the paint surface.
So you're putting the sketch on there before the base plaster goes up. Then the base plaster covers up all of it.
Yes, but you have to sort of you establish grid lines so that you can follow, and so you know exactly where that image is going. And then you put that image up on the scratch code.
I had no idea what a scratch code is.
Well, there are usually three levels of
the scratch coat of plaster. Okay.
Yeah, of plaster.
And that's the first level, or that?
There's one. It's a scratch coat, and then the brown coat, and then there's the intonaco, which is the final.
The one with which you move the painting in, or the colors into for the final.
And the one that we call arricciata, but it's a brown coat. It's the one right before the next to last coat. You organize the entire picture on that wall and transfer it by tracing it. And
using the same papers that you use.
And trying to, at that point, if there's anything that needs to be moved or changed, you can see it then. But if you don't, then you start laying the plaster on top of it and pouncing the image again.
So whereas if you're in oils, mm-hmm. you have more freedom to change your mind and even on the basic framework just by here – you're locked in to the basic.
You're locked into your drawing. That's right.
And then this is not the right term, but the second phase of the artistry then is as you apply the colors to the overall plan, using your eyes to make the final adjustments to have the right color scheme.
Well, you do a color sketch beforehand, so you know what it looks like. And then, for instance, John Dempsey does all the colors. So
he does all the colors in the sense that he applies them to art. Makes them. What does he mean by that? John Dempsey, he's in the studio with us, but he can't talk. We don't let him.
the colors are pigments. They're the color pigment. And you just grind them with water and make a paint out of them.
But then you mix it in with the plaster, or do you apply it to the plaster?
You then apply it. So if for instance, we tend to have as many as four or five flesh tones that go from the highest flesh to the darkest.
Well.
For a cloak or some sort of cloth, we have at least three for those. This is when John has to.
So John's there. He's got all the pigments. He grinds it up. He gets it ready. Now, does John also apply it, or do you?
He mixes up the colors that we need.
And then you up there to put it on there?
And then they come to me, and then I can put them on.
Well, this is so interesting in the sense that it does become a team operation. Who else do you have to have to do? Is it just you and John who's doing the colors, or do you have some other people who have important artistic roles?
Well, I've had some very good help with plaster. Christopher Holt has been doing a lot of
the basic hardcore plaster work you're talking about, or the artistic plaster work that goes?
It's both.
A little of both?
Yes. They've got to – the final – layer of plaster has to be pretty good.
If I'm your student, mm-hmm. and you develop confidence in me, would you have your students who are like hand in glove with you? Would you have them working beside you to do pieces of the work, or do you insist on putting every little piece of color in yourself?
Well, I tend to do everything that's my painting, but we also do. When they have an opportunity to take a break on their own, they can do their own frescoes
just like
on
you
the
did
side,
just like you with when you were
to learn how to do it themselves. And this everything that Christopher Holt and John Dempsey and Roger Nelson have learned. They learned the same way I did, which is you learn from the bottom up. You learn how to mix the plaster and lay the plaster. You know how to mix the colors and adjust them correctly and learn that in fresco it's a very different from oil and tempera because the colors change as they dry. So you've got to be pretty.
You've got
aware
to have done it once or twice before, so you know what the not what the color looks
and
like now, but what
to
it's
run
going
out
to be.
Of color either. Because
what do you mean about that?
If you run out of a color and you still need that color, it's hard to mix it to be just
so quickly.
Like, because you can't. You're not judging the color anymore by what you've already painted.
Well, when you do run into a problem like that, and I don't want to say it's a mistake, but it's something that you're not satisfied with. Do you just put a little more plaster on it and mix some more color, or do you have to knock it off and start? I mean,
if you make a big mistake, you usually have to just tear out the day's work and start it the next day. A day's section of plaster usually lasts 8 to 12 hours. So you're working, and you can mess up that last bit in the last 30 minutes sometimes, and you'll have to take the whole thing out.
Well, we're visiting.
You try not to do that.
I bet you do. Visiting with Ben Long, we're talking about frescoes, but we've also been talking about Ben Long's current assignment, which is the oil portrait of President Erskine Bowles. Ben Long and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We've been talking about the connection between art and religion. And what I'm really pressing is, you give these religious messages. Does it come out of a deep religious faith or just a interest in religion or a feeling that religious themes carry us and move us in ways that other art might not? Are you preaching to us with your...
Oh, well, I don't know if I'd say that part, but I think the impact of... And also because these are very often powerful human stories as well.
Yeah.
That it's something that does interest me quite a bit. I think it's and to be able to try to relate that in some way that can give a viewer thought, that would be nice. In fact, it's usually what I find would be the happy end result of a painting.
We just got a minute or two more. I want to visit just a little bit, turning back to your assignment. Your current assignment is in an oil painting of Erskine Bowles. You mentioned earlier that you and Erskine go back to your times at college and that you worked in the clothing store together. Can you, you remember the first time you met him and how that friendship developed?
Well, I think I met him before, but it's being thrown in working with him.
Where were y'all working?
What's the name of the place? Some kind of country gentleman or something like that.
Uh-huh. And you were selling back in those days. What were the clothing styles back then?
It was all the button-down things. I haven't seen that the clothing style has changed that much. But it's
We used to call it like the Ivy League kind of style, which was kind of being in when I was in college. That was right in the middle of it. It was getting kind of phased out, I guess. Really, you were here in the mid to late 60s, or you?
No, I was here from 63.
Mid 60s. It was a little different time. People started wearing long hair and,
they hadn't quite when I left. I mean, when I went up to New York, it definitely worked.
Who was the better salesman?
Yeah, I don't know. I would say he was.
How what was Erskine's sales approach? I mean,
he convinced people that they were
Looked good.
They were on the right track.
When you were a student here, you Reynolds Price is a teacher at Duke, mm-hmm. but he came over. Didn't he to teach a class at Chapel Hill? And did you have a class from Reynolds?
When I came here, I was in that. I think it was the first Bachelor of Fine Arts program. There were about seven of us, and Jesse Rader was this great teacher of creative writing, and she brought in Reynolds. And I, of course, I thought he went to school there, or studied there. But I think he was pretty fresh out of Oxford at the time.
Right.
And we became good friends then, and still are.
The story that I remember, and I bet I got it wrong, so tell me your side of it. But I remember Reynolds telling, really with pride, that you had been his student.
Mm-hmm.
He told the story to illustrate his feeling about the real intersection between the creative processes as it results as it comes to bear in writing, careful writing, mm-hmm. which involves both the creative spirit and a little bit of hard work with art, with your work. And he said you were pretty good at both. You know, that you – he said Ben could have been a good writer. But when I saw his sketches, I can't remember how he happened to see your sketches.
I brought him in. And
you brought him to class?
I wanted him to see them.
And what – can you remember what you'd drawn or what the sketches were?
Just – no, I can't.
Just people or
– people, mainly. Uh-huh. But I think it was then that I was really going through knowing that since I moved into the senior year there, I wasn't going to be a writer. And I knew what I wanted to be and didn't know how to go about it. But it took some encouragement, and that's all I needed. He just said, stop wasting time. Stop. You know, get to work. Go there.
Well, the next question should be, well, then what happened then?
I had a very interesting year up in New York City trying to figure out how to, you know, make money and live there at the same time trying to.
But ultimately you had to go to Europe to get your feet on the ground.
Well, that was a bad time of year to be leaving any school. And I sort of found myself in the Marine Corps. So that took away some time. Mm-hmm.
We'll have to come back and visit about the Marine Corps experiences and your others. But, man, what a great hour. Ben Long, thanks for visiting with us. Thanks for coming to help give us a permanent reminder of the administration of Erskine Bowles. We look forward to seeing your portrait when it's ready.
I look forward to that, too.
We look forward to visiting with you maybe some other time when you're in town.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Ben Long, and thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. I'll be right back here soon.